We are continuing in our story of Exodus. Last week, we talked about how Exodus and the Mount Sinai covenant is very much placed in the language and the symbol of a marriage. And we talked about how this is the time when God sort of says to Israel, I've rescued you, I've brought you out, I love you. You're not the greatest of the nations, let's be honest. I just rescued you because I love you. And now that I've done that and brought you out, would you like to be mine? Do you want to be in covenantal relationship with me? And God uses very much symbolic marriage language that then later on will be used by prophets and by Jesus and by disciples and by the Apostle Paul, all the way through the book of Revelation. And we talked about that beautiful, wonderful covenant that's there. Today we're going to talk about why this covenant is deeply unique and has not just changed not just built a shelf for how we read our whole Bible. If you'll remember, the title of what we're doing for this whole year is Garden to Garden. We're going from Genesis, from the garden at the very beginning, the Garden of Eden, to Revelation, when we see this beautiful New Jerusalem coming down and a new garden being planted and built, and the leaves of the trees are good for the healing of the nations. And when we see those two gardens, we're doing this like big scope and sequence of the text. What we're trying to do is grab hold of the big pieces that we want you to pay attention to, because they're going to pop up repeatedly as primary symbols and themes, like marriage. And we've talked about how that symbol and theme is going to shape the rest of our narrative story. Like, you can't really know Jesus' teachings if you don't know that Sinai was a marriage covenant. But I'm going to argue today that Sinai and this covenant is not just important for the way we will read the rest of our text and how we understand Sinai, the Sinai covenant and the introduction of laws and commandments and culture and ritual and ceremony. But I'm going to argue that I think Sinai has changed the world, and that the world that we're in today, for better and for worse, is shaped by the Sinai covenant, and that many of us are longing for it again. There is a transcendent uniqueness of the Sinai covenant. When you look at the rest of the histories and religions around the world, what happens at Sinai is different and distinct than what is going to happen everywhere else. The revelation at Sinai is unique in the history of all of humankind. God's Sinai revelation is to an entire nation, an entire people, not just one individual. You know, previously we've had covenants with Noah or with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. But right now we're going to have a people, a whole people. And this unique thing, you guys, this is the craziest bit. This is going to include everyone. And this is how Sinai starts. It's all the people were gathered there. And we know, because of the description and narrative of the text, that it's going to include young, old, men, women, children, righteous, not yet righteous, slave, free, Israelites, strangers, those who are abled, those who are disabled, rich, poor, everyone is there. And everyone is going to get the chance to say to God, yes, we would like to be in this covenant with you. Moses says in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 32 through 33, ask now about the former days, long before your time, from the day God created humans on earth. Ask from one end of the heavens to the other. Has anything so great as this ever happened? Has anything like it ever been heard of? Has any other people, not an individual, but a whole people, heard the voice of God speaking out of fire as you have and have lived? Like, this whole people saw it and experienced it all at once. Wouldn't it be nice to walk around in a community where if you were saying to somebody, like, I had this experience with God, and they were like, yeah, me too. And then you saw the next person, you're like, did you know I had this crazy experience with God at this mountain? And they're like, me too. And every person you met for 40 years walking around that wilderness as part of your camp was like, me too. Wasn't that crazy? I was there. I heard it. I saw no form, but I heard God speak, and I saw the fire, and I saw the smoke, and I heard the voices, and we were all there. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory, was the chief rabbi of the UK, said this, that at Sinai, a new kind of nation was being formed, a new kind of society, one that would be, antithesis of Egypt, where the few had power and many were enslaved. It was to be, in Abraham Lincoln's words in the Gettysburg Address, a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Indeed, without the covenant at Mount Sinai, Rabbi Sacks argues, Lincoln's words might have been inconceivable. For nowhere else do we find anything like the politics of Mount Sinai with its radical vision of a society held together not by power, but by the free consent of its citizens to be bound individually and collectively by a moral code and by a covenant with God. Isn't that an amazing thing to consider? The radical shift that every Israelite there, every person there at the base of Mount Sinai, every Israelite, every Egyptian, everyone listening in is trying to think, wait, we've just escaped a power, a principality, a place of governance where there's been all the power collected into one person, one individual, one king. And instead now here, things are shifting. Long before the Greek philosophers, and far more profoundly, at Mount Sinai, the concept of a free society is born. Standard works on the history of the politics of freedom will trace it back to Marx or Rousseau and Hobbes, to Plato's Republic, Aristotle's Politics, and Athens of the 5th century BCE. That's great, but this is a serious error because, to be sure, even though words like democracy, rule by the people, are Greek in origin, the concept dates to Mount Sinai. And it's not possible without this story. Long before Israel enters the land, long before they acquire their own system of government, they will enter into this Sinai covenant with God, which sets moral limits on the exercise of human power. The Torah established for the first time in world history the primacy of right over might. Right over might. And any king who would behave contrarily to Torah was acting beyond their own legitimate authority. And that king, that Israelite king coming forward, could be challenged simply on the basis that their behavior is not in line with God's commands. That is amazing. Revolutionary. In fact, the very beginning of our Exodus narrative enshrines this. Ancient Israelites were empowered to obey God and to get into good trouble, to disobey illegal or immoral orders from rulers. The book of Exodus opens with Hebrew midwives, say their names, Shiphrah and Puah, who feared God and did not do what the Egyptian king had commanded. The story starts with civil disobedience. The story starts with women saying to the powers, might does not count more than right. And this community, this story, this Exodus narrative, this Sinai covenant changes everything. It was on this tradition that Calvin, inspiration of the 17th century Puritan radicals in England and America, drew when he said, prophets and teachers may take courage and thus boldly set themselves against kings and nations. It was on this same tradition that Thomas Paine based his pamphlet, Common Sense, written in 1776, widely credited at the time as the inspiration that led to the American Revolution. And historically, it was the covenant at Sinai and all that flowed from it that inspired the birth of freedom in America. Sinai changed everything. And what God does for Israel, God is doing for the whole world through Israel. This is not a gift that only Israel gets. This is a gift that Israel will bear the responsibility for, the covenantal call to live in such a way as they abide by the covenant of Sinai, that the world will know that there is a God in Israel. That the world will know. This is the reputation of God will be found through this covenant. The Sinai covenant is to be the way of life for this rescued people. And God will go with them and be with them. And the text says, and live in them. This is how God can live with us, is in the context of this beautiful, amazing covenant. You know, the Torah is often referred to as a tree of life. something that gives us shade, that its roots go down deep. People who sit and study Torah are talked about in the Psalms as those who are sitting at a tree and drinking deep from its roots, from this beautiful shade that is there. It's an incredible picture. The Torah is spoken of, and here's our beautiful Torah ark right here that has, it's not ours, it's Atzraim's. We just get to stand next to it, but it's okay. This is for all the people. And this beautiful, do you guys see the tree? This, do you know Atzraim means tree of life? That's this congregation's name. And it's because the Torah is a tree of life. It is born from here. And up there in the flame letters, it says Israel. That the Torah is the way, the truth, and the life. The Torah, that's when Jesus says that, you guys, I'm the way, the truth, and life. He's like, I am the fulfillment. I am living out Torah for you. I am the life of that. The Sinai covenant is to be the way of life for a rescued people. And what's very unique about this covenant is that right at the beginning, the consent of the governed is required. God will be king. God will be ruler. And in Exodus 19, 3 through 6, it says, this is what you are to say to the house of Jacob. Tell the people of Israel, God instructs Moses. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings, brought you to me. There's that marriage language right there. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, you will be my treasured possession. For the whole earth is mine. You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, we often read this like, we'll only get this good thing if I do all this work. It's not so much that. It's, do you want this? Do you want to take on the obedience, what is called the yoke of Torah? Do you want to take on the yoke of this covenant? And Israel gets to say yes or no. Moses tells us the people and they reply, Exodus 19:8, we will do everything the Lord has said. There is no legitimate government without the consent of the governed, even if the governor is the creator of heaven and earth. We find that both before and after the revelation at Sinai, God commands Moses to make sure the people do actually agree. That they say, yes, I want this. We agree. Yes, we want your commands. We want to take on the beauty of this incredible nation that you are bringing to pass. You see, the free God desires the free worship of free human beings. God does not act tyrannically with God's creatures. God wants to rule by might, by right, not by might. The God who brought an enslaved people to liberty seeks the free worship of free human beings. And if God does not act as a tyrant, neither should we. Sinai starts with the politics of freedom. And with freedom comes our free will. We get to say yes or no. We get to say we want it or we don't. We can say, yes, I will. I willingly and desire to take on this covenant of God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is your God. The Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Do you want to do that? Then you say, yes, everything I have. I want to love God with all of it. And with freedom comes free will. Because a love that is demanded is no love at all. And so we know our own story. We know that while the covenant is being made, while that beautiful marriage covenant, almost like a ketubah, that marriage covenant is later on developed in the Judean practice, a marriage covenant there. While that's happening, down below, the people are like, well, let's make some idols. Breaking number one, right at the beginning, right? You shall have no other gods before me. Don't make any graven images. Don't think, okay, got that. So what you're saying is, do have other gods before you. Do make graven images. Let's get this done. Now, idols particularly pop up in our community and our human nature in various different ways. Oftentimes people make idols out of things we can see in creation, right? There's sun worship, there's moon worship, there's the worship of animals or of trees. Oftentimes, and this is what's sort of most common to us and in our Sinai story, idols are objects that are made with human hands. Somebody goes out tosses some gold into a fire, out comes a calf. Maybe it's a little more complicated than that. Goes out, finds their favorite totem, makes it something out there that we can look and worship at. Those two, I find Christians really are great at saying, let's not do those two things. So much so that as somebody just pokes their head out, some Jesus-loving person who's like, hey, maybe we should care for the earth. They're like, ah, idol worship. I'm like, no, I'm being a good steward. Have you not read Genesis, right? And they're like, never read it. So only to argue about 24-hour days. Okay, so anyway, we have we're really good at this. Okay, we have a whole portion in church history, the iconoclast movement, where we just like, let's go and destroy all the icons. Doesn't matter if they're valuable to people that we don't understand, right? Sisters and brothers of ours. So we're really great at avoiding objects visible in creation as idols. We're really great at rejecting objects made with human hands as idols. But here's the kicker for most of us. A false god of our own making is the next big one. A human construct for political purposes, for power, for control, for national advancement, for security. Now, I don't care which is your favorite brand of idol worship, but all are exercises in futility. None will work. Ezekiel chapter 29, verse 3, God commands Ezekiel to say this, I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you great monster lying among your streams. You say, the Nile belongs to me. I made it for myself. The Bible will call out repeatedly through prophets, through the Exodus narrative and story, through the whole of Torah, and repeatedly say, this is not yours. You did not make it. You did not earn it. You get it by blessing. You don't control it. You don't manipulate it. God is in charge. You're not. In fact, if I were to say, like, growing up, I grew up Lutheran, and so, you know, it was evangelical adjacent, because it was the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And in that setting, then, we didn't use a lot of language, like, when did you make your personal decision to follow Jesus, and are you saved, and stuff like that. Just didn't happen. I just grew up knowing the love of Jesus. And when I started meeting other Christians, like the weird ones, they're always trying to convert me. I was like, I'm already Christian, people. They kept saying, when did you make your decision for Jesus? And so I started feeling like, okay, I guess I need a date. Like, I have to have an actual date. I'm like, I was baptized. They're like, were you dunked? I'm like, I was sprinkled, but I was a grown-up. I was 13. They're like, doesn't count. Get in the water. I'm like, it counts. That was very important to me. And I remember trying to figure out, when was that date? When was the moment? I'll tell you when the moment was. I could figure it out. I was sitting by myself. And I had this kind of picture of myself just being little. I was like 12. And I pictured God like above me looking down. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm not in charge. I'm not in charge. You're God. I'm not. And it wasn't scary. It felt helpful. I was glad to not be in charge. And I was glad to know who was. When we think about these idols, for many of us it's money. When we think of how the world works, we'll ask ourselves questions like who makes massive and almost instant fortunes and clever deals in financial markets? What societies would have individuals who have accumulated vast amounts of wealth in business with or without effective scrutiny, are lauded as assumed experts in other quite unrelated fields of human interaction? Politics, for example. The extent of corruption by corporate lobbying and the staggering scale of money spent on getting elected exposes our idol. Money rules. And we seem content to be ruled by the best government that money can buy. And the church is not immune to this either. We think bigger is better. We act as though those with the largest buildings, with the largest pulpit, with the most published books, are oracles from Delphi, and we should all go and sit at their feet. The Torah teaches a different way. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 17 through 18. You may say to yourself, my power, God is speaking to Israel, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me. But remember, the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. This is nothing we've done. Friends, we are the maker of our own gods. Human beings did not need the devil to teach us idolatry. We can do it all by ourselves. We will happily make our own pocket gods, our own buddy Jesus, of our own understanding, in order to try to control God, our world, in order to try to control microbes and cancer cells, in order to try to control the uncontrollable. We will try to make God of our own making. I've been teaching Garden to Garden for many years, at least 14, 15, 16 years. And I've been thinking about it a lot longer than that. And when we would first start teaching this, I didn't have such like an opt-in sparky audience. Sometimes there were some skeptics. I don't know if you've met them. What's this crazy girl doing with all her nonsense? And so I would put up a few rules for play as we had our big room. And I would say, before we get into the nonsense I'm going to share with you, and you're going to want to argue with me, that's fine. I love that, by the way. Ask all the questions. We would have a few rules of play. And here were the rules I would put up. And for those of you who've been in those old garden classes, you recognize them. One, we'd say, we're going to commit to civility and reconciliation. So you can ask a real question and you can really disagree and we're still going to be friends at the end of this time together. And we would say there's safety in the questions. This is not Survivor, all right? So nobody's getting voted off the island and you can ask any question you want. Like you could say, I don't think this is real. How do we know Moses wrote this? I don't like this part. I wish it wasn't there. I'm really confused today. I'm not sure which way is up. We could do all that, and we were going to hold that confidence. We weren't going to walk out and go, did you know that this person is definitely on their way to heresy, and Pastor Danielle didn't do anything to stop it, right? Like all those kind of things. But here's the kicker. Number four was the most important to me, that we were going to commit together as a community, as we studied this text, we're going to commit to the complete rejection of idolatry. And I would explain. That means that each one of us, myself included, have walked in here with our own understanding, our own favorite sermon, our own seminary degrees, and we've walked in here with our understanding of who we think God is. But as St. Augustine said, if you think you know, then it's not God you're talking about. Embrace a little mystery. And so we would say we're going to reject the idol, even the one we've made for ourselves and called Jesus. Maybe there are things about that person, Jesus, that are true. Yes, of course. But maybe there's some things that need some tweaking. Maybe, I don't know, he's not white. Perhaps. Maybe Jesus didn't go to church. Maybe that's something you need to set aside. Right? Maybe there's some things that we grew up with that we needed to step aside. One of my dear friends, faithful follower of Jesus, always did everything right. She's amazing. So excited for her first child to be born. Her first child was born severely disabled. Spent year one of life in the hospital, on the edge of survival. And I would go and I would sit with her and we would talk and we would pray. And this woman is a saint. Like she did all the things. She's pro-life. She did the marches. She went and spoke at high schools, a voice like a songbird, a faithful wife, a faithful daughter, faithful, just amazing, loves Jesus more than anything. And we would sit there by this tiny little cradle, watching her daughter grasp for life, surgery after surgery. And she said to me, I still believe in Jesus, but he's remaking himself in front of me. And that's what we mean by the rejection of idolatry. That we've maybe walked in there thinking, buddy, Jesus is just vending machine Jesus. And I'm going to pray my prayer and I'm going to get the good thing out. And so we have to work through this when we meet the God of the text. When we actually read the book. And we find the verses that are deeply disturbing and we don't like at all. And then lastly, we always ask, what did this mean to, not what does it mean to me? Like we don't open up the book of Psalms and go, how does this speak to me in my life first? We first say, what did it mean to them? And then we can ask what it meant to us. We have to ask that first question. Because otherwise, you're going to open up the book of Psalms and decide it's totally fine for you to curse your enemies and kill them and ask God to kill them and all the other things, right? Because the Psalms are somebody just having a good or a bad day. 70% of them are bad days. The good news, Christopher Wright argues in his book, Here Are Your Gods. And he wrote this book several years ago, in the last 5-10 years. If idols are primarily human constructs, then they are our own responsibility. We pay their debts, we clean up their mess, we suffer their consequences. Gods and idols are fundamentally what we've made, and they are as destructive as we are ourselves, for they are the work of our own hands, and our hands are full of blood. But there is hope, because history is the graveyard of idols. Sinai made that happen. Sinai changed the world. This last weekend, we remembered the 57th anniversary of Dr. King's last sermon, I've Been to the Mountaintop. He gave that sermon at Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, April 3rd, 1968, and then was assassinated the next day. In that sermon, he says, I wonder if God were asking me this question. If I were standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather across, the Red Sea, through the wilderness on toward the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. And then he continues on. I wouldn't stop here at this point of history. I wouldn't stop here. And then he says, strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now that's a strange statement to make, he says, because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick, trouble is in the land, confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men, in some strange way, are responding. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace. But now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or nonexistence. And that is where we are today. Now he's going to do a much better job saying what we need to hear.
We say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Sinai didn't just change our biblical narrative. Sinai changed the world. This is the mountaintop that Dr. King is talking about. He's been to the mountain. He's seen the glory of the Lord. The ancient Hebrews handed down these divine directives from generation to generation. Theirs was an intellectually rigorous tradition that shaped all those who identified with that community into a truly wise people amidst a world filled with competing visions. And this tradition passed down through texts and rituals and narrative and poetry and voices of the community makes up this philosophy, this ancient Hebrew philosophy, a way of being a people, depicting their own understanding of how the Creator had ordered the world. That all are made free. That all are made in the image and the likeness of God. That we should love our neighbor and love the stranger. And love and care for the Egyptian, remembering that we were once strangers there. To care for our enemy as they fall down, as their donkey falls down under its load, to stop and to help. To ensure that those who are blind are not left behind, that nobody puts a stumbling block in front of them. To ensure that those who are deaf are not mocked. To ensure that the widow and the orphan and the stranger are placed on equal footing at that mountain. The Sinai Covenant instructs us in the right way of walking in the world that God has made. And this is not just a worldview. It is a way of living in the world. The ancient Hebrews understood the Sinai Covenant to be prescriptive at its heart. It is a life to be fleshed out in community. We are to live differently together. We are to do something differently together. And from the very beginning of the book, we discover that God is calling us to get into good trouble. To follow the example of Shifra and Puah. To not obey a king who's built an empire on the backs of those most vulnerable and disenfranchised amongst us. But instead, to know what is right and to fear God. Now, Spark has been here before. You know, the conversation about what do we do. Now, we're not partisan, but we can be political because the Bible is political. Jesus is political. And when we have been here before, some of us, for the very first time, started getting involved in action together. Now, one of the first things that we did was we organized a big protest when children were being separated from their families at the border. And we were joined by Sparkers and by Etsniks and then by just random people who saw us there and pulled their car aside and got out and grabbed a sign. When George Floyd was murdered in the middle of the pandemic, Pastor Mark and Kwame and others started leading a weekly, every single Sunday protest on Sunday afternoon, and this was our church. We weren't permitted yet to gather together because of the pandemic, so we would stand on the corner and wear our masks and witness to the need for justice, for racial justice in our community. And as we started to do this and started to get involved in different ways in which we're trying to just raise our voices as followers of Jesus, not because we're liberal, we aren't. Not because we're progressive, we aren't. We're innocent. Guess what we are? We are disciples of Jesus. And Jesus's commands are clear. Very clear. When I am hungry, did you give me something to eat? When I was thirsty, did you give me something to drink? When I was in prison, sick, did you visit me? When I was a stranger, did you welcome me in? And if you did it to one of the least of these, then you did that for me. And so we stand here because we want to welcome the stranger, because Jesus told us to. That's it. Now, a lot of us would say, okay, we stood out there, we protested. You know, some people even flew to have a concurrent protest down at Clinton, Texas, while we were doing this one. What changed? And here we are again. What changed? So I put these slides together, and I'm going to share them again. When we protest, what happens? Well, we show that we as Christians are commanded to pursue justice and love others because we're following the commands of Jesus. Whoever claims to live in him must walk as Jesus walked. 1 John 2:6. When we protest, we show that this is what Jesus' followers do. They speak up for people whose voice is being marginalized, taken away, disenfranchised. When we protest, we stand as witnesses for those suffering. We refuse to allow their tears, their pain, their blood to fall on the ground without crying out. And we want our sisters and brothers who are being harmed to know that we are crying out for them, standing on street corners, writing letters, demanding justice. Y'all, if something happens to me, I better see y'all in a corner. Write a letter, at least do 5 calls. I mean, that's just on your app. You can do that. Number 3, when we protest, we teach and demonstrate to our children, the next generation, what is right. And when our children ask us someday, where were you when this happened that I'm reading about in my history book? God, please let us have this in a history book and not a newspaper. Where were you when this happened? You will have an answer. We will have an answer. We were there. When we protest, we move the needle. Our vigils gain attention in the media and online. Guess what happened when we protested? The media showed up. And it was in the New York Times and Palo Alto. And guess what? Spark grew by the people who were looking for us. They were wondering if there were any Christians out there that cared. Our vigils gain attention in the media and online. Politicians respond. Attorneys and activists are encouraged. Those people out there doing the work, attorneys out there all the time doing the work, they probably wonder if anybody cares. We care. Changes can be made in those systems. And religious and civic leaders who may be thinking that it's too political or a debatable issue will see us and they can be convicted. I wear my collar when I protest. I wear my collar and a big cross. I want people to know I'm here because of Jesus. We move the needle for everyone watching. Guess what? Beginning with ourselves. I get to put that on. You guys picked out good t-shirts yesterday. You made good signs. We see ourselves changing. Number 5, and this is what happened the last time, we find like-minded people along the way. We get encouraged. We encourage others. We find some hope when we find others who share our anger and our passion and our compassion. And we learn from others who are further along in this journey. Yesterday, I saw some of you making friends, people you never met before, exchanging contact information, finding somebody else there that also cared. When we protest, we get louder and stronger together. Strength in numbers means that our cries for justice, for humanitarian aid, for policy changes, for climate justice can gain influence in the debate so that we can get implementation. Things change. I know it can feel like some of us just walked in the hot sun yesterday way too slow, and we just got the enthusiastic honks from a few other people, And we wonder, did anything change? I think some things changed. And we had a good time. One of our sparkers, Jenna Bitson Brown, sent me this yesterday before we went out. It's a nice little article on Substack by Suzanne Crawford O'Brien. You should definitely go and check it out. It's entitled, "When Protest is a Ceremony, It Changes the World. Let's Make Some Magic." And it's easy to think, she says, that actions like these are pointless, that they're just symbolic. But oh, honey, never tell a religious studies professor that something's just symbolic. Because symbols, ritual, and narrative have the power to change the world. It's the language of world making. Friends, Sinai changed the world. Keep telling the story. Keep meditating on the scriptures. Keep doing what the scriptures tell us to do and pursue the way of Jesus. Amen. We now turn to this beautiful covenant that Christ continues. Symbols, but much more than symbols, aren't they? Much more than just symbols. It's a moment of hope where we gather around the table with our rabbi, with our Messiah, our Savior, our Lord. And he says, in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed, and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying to you, take, eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. All who are hungry, come eat. All who are thirsty, come and drink. All are welcome at this table.